It is again good to stand before you this morning to talk about things that relate to our service to God. And I am so glad that you have come this morning. It is, of course, a great encouragement to each of us as we greet one another, as we sing songs of praise and edify one another. And, of course, as a preacher of the gospel, it's always a little bit easier when you have an audience. And, of course, that's what I've always found when I come to San Marcos. You have brethren who care, about spiritual things, and that means a lot. There are a lot of things that I would like to say. I do have a lesson that requires a great deal of my time this morning, so I need to get right to it. I do want to, of course, you know, Brother and Sister Jenkins are here. I appreciate them being here this morning, and known Brother Jenkins for quite some time. They knew my wife before I knew her, which, of course, would prompt some to say, well, I wish I had been able to talk to him before I met her, but that's neither here nor there. He could have tried to talk me out of it, and it wouldn't have worked, and I'd be glad it didn't. Because I got a true gem, but they've known my wife a good while, and I, of course, first knew about them through his writings and through her, and have come to respect the love and the devotion that they have for truth. And, of course, Brother Jenkins has been slipping me a little information the last few months. I've been trying to get a debate going over there on institutionalism, and he's been kind of slipping me a little information and some insight here and there, and I've really appreciated that. He's been a big help, and appreciate him very much. Well, let me get right to the point this morning. We want to talk about the question of whether or not you can put away a mate who puts you away. Now, that may seem like a really dumb question. How can you put away a mate who has already put you away? If they've put you away, then you can't put them away. Well, you would think that you couldn't, but we're talking about the Bible now. And when you start talking about the Bible, you get people doing all kinds of things with it. And you know what they do? We've been dealing with this for years and years and years with the denominations. They go and they begin to twist words around. And they make associations with other things that actually don't belong, but they associate things that ought not to be associated in the Scriptures. They do special pleading. They create straw men. And you'll find the emotionalism. And, of course, this is big for the emotion. This is ripe for the emotion. Oh, you've got a man here. He puts away his wife. She had slaved over that stove for years and years. And she had borne his children. And here he goes. And he runs off. Well, nobody is saying that that's fair. Nobody's saying, you know, that's good. That's his prerogative. No one's saying that. But, of course, we create the emotion of now what can the wife do? And we all admit, all of us, that there are situations where the wife does not have a recourse. Even those who take the position that I will be opposing in our lesson this morning, even they will admit that there are situations where the wife does not have a recourse. There's nothing she can do about it. But they've slipped a little something in here to try to give some help. And that's what we want to talk about. We want to talk about a situation where two people are married, and let's just say for a moment that the man puts the wife away. There's been no fornication. He just got tired of her, and they couldn't get along, and you know, it's the same old story. He doesn't understand me anymore. She nags me all the time. And so they end up with a divorce. Now, we've all seen situations like that. And, of course, we can feel for those people in those situations, particularly the wife who is put away. When we look at Matthew 19 and verse 9, Jesus really speaks very clearly on this issue. He is answering a question here that has been brought to his attention about whether or not a man can put away his wife for any reason. And after some discussion on this, he comes down to the law in verse 9 here, and he tells us that whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality, that's fornication, except for fornication and marries another, commits adultery. So if he divorces her and marries someone else, he's committing adultery in doing that. That's clear enough, isn't it? Except for fornication, though. So if he divorces her because she was cheating on him, then of course he's divorced her for fornication, and now he can remarry. That's clear enough. I mean, you really can't miss that. The exception negates the consequence, and we have had brethren in the past who've denied that, but look it up in Webster's. That's what an exception does. Except for fornication. Then we have the other side of the coin. Whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery. And so she's been put away by her husband, whether he put her away just because they couldn't get along, or whether he put her away because she committed fornication. In either case, she commits adultery in remarrying, or whoever marries her, as Jesus puts it, commits adultery in marrying her. Well, that's very understandable. Unless you want to prove something. Unless you want to start taking and playing with words. For example, if a man divorces his wife for just any reason and marries another, he commits adultery. That's what that says, right? That's what that says. What is adultery? We're told when we look into the lexicons and the expository dictionaries, we look at what the scholars have to say, we are told that to commit adultery, you must be married. It is an act by a married individual or with a married individual. And so there's a marriage involved in adultery. Oh, well, now wait a minute. If the man in this verse has put away his wife and he commits adultery in marrying someone else, then he must still be married to her. And here's where we come to this phrase. It's been around since before I was conscious of doctrinal or spiritual matters. And that's still married in the eyes of God. Oh, they're still married. Now, the reason we did that was we were trying to explain why it was that he could be unmarried now. He's divorced her, but he's still committing adultery. How can that be? So we would explain it, well, they're still married in the eyes of God. Hopefully, before this lesson is over, you, if you are prone to using that expression, you will stop using it. Because I know what a person means by that. But we made that up. There's nothing in the scriptures that say they are still married in the eyes of God. That's the way we explained it. But I think we got that wrong. Now, while it may have helped us to understand the consequences, at the same time, it has led some to say, well, if they're still married in the eyes of God, then that woman that was put away, she can still put him away when he remarries and commits adultery. He's committed adultery now. So he commits adultery, they're divorced, but they're still married in the eyes of God, so now he's committed adultery. She can put him away in her mind. Oh, now she can remarry. Let's look at Jack and Jill for just a moment. This is Jack and Jill, and I know he looks an awful lot like me, but our hair is parted on the opposite side, and so please do not make any association. Jack and Jill, they're married, but they can't get along, as I mentioned the scenario a moment ago. And since they cannot get along, they end up getting divorced. There's no fornication involved. Jack just decides to put away Jill. About a year later, Jack meets Jane. And he falls in love with Jane, and he marries Jane. So now Jack and Jane are married. Jack and Jill have divorced. Jack and Jane are married. And of course, our passage in Matthew 19 and verse 9 tells us that Jack is committing adultery in that marriage with Jane. Oh, but if he's committing adultery with Jane, then what about Jill? Jill believes she's still married in the eyes of God with Jack. Otherwise, Jesus wouldn't have said they commit adultery in remarrying. So they're still married in the eyes of God. So Jill says, well, if they're still married in the eyes of God, then I can now put away Jack for this adultery that he's committing and remarrying someone else. I'll tell you what, when we want something, we can really twist something around, can't we? We can really twist it around. But I'll tell you, it sounds reasonable. And if you've always been using this phrase, still married in the eyes of God, it's people that have been using that phrase, they've set themselves up for years for this. Now, I'm not saying everybody that used that phrase. I used to use that phrase myself. You know why I stopped? Nobody said, Bob, you know, that's not in the Bible. The reason I stopped was I read Matthew 19:9 and I studied it and I studied it and I studied it. And I said, Jesus said they're divorced. Either they're divorced or they're not divorced. It does not say they're still married in the eyes of God. We talk about speaking where the Bible speaks and being silent where the Bible is silent. And then we come up with something like that. They're not still married in the eyes of God. But Jill thinks they are, so she's going to put them away. Now, she can't do it in a civil suit, can she? Because Jack already put her away. Since it can't be done civilly, there must be a way to do it. Otherwise, Jesus wouldn't have said he commits adultery and therefore they're still married in the eyes of God. I know it's confusing, but this is what they do. And of course, the confusion is a part of it. You know, if you can get confusing, you can convince people, well, you must be really smart and you must know what you're talking about. Well, I'm telling you right now, this is not smart. Since they're still married in the eyes of God, she can put him away. Now, they'll go to a lexicon, and they'll camp out on Walter Bauer, or they'll camp out on Thayer, and they'll camp out on this idea of divorce, and apoluo, and they'll give us the Greek, and they will tell us it means to repudiate. It does not necessarily indicate a civil proceeding, and they will tell us, she has the right to put him away in her mind. She can repudiate him in her mind. This is where the description of this as being mental divorce comes from. Now, people who take this position don't like that. Even though the opponents of the position didn't actually come up with that phrase, still they don't like it. Mental divorce, but that's exactly what it is. It's putting someone away in your mind. And what they do is they tell us they have different restrictions. You know, one of the restrictions is that she could not want the divorce. When Jack divorced her, she had to be opposed to it. Even fight it if she could. Otherwise, she can't put... Now, I'd like to find that in Matthew 19:9. You see, they're sticking something in there. But what they're doing is they're sabbing. They're sabbing this thing over. They're making her as innocent as they possibly can. Well, what if neither of them were believers? What if she knew nothing about what Jesus said about divorce and remarriage? She had no idea about this. He put her away. She didn't know she ought to be fighting it. Oh, well, that doesn't matter. Jesus doesn't say anything about her fighting it. You see, we're sticking stuff in there. Some of these fellows tell you, she'll need to come before the church and make an announcement. She'll need to go to the elders and have them make an announcement. You see, I'd like to find that in there too. You know, Jesus did speak of going to the church later, earlier in Matthew chapter 18. He talks about a brother who has a brother who has offended in some way. And it ends up being told to the church. You know, I can read about Jesus talking about that, but it's not in chapter 19. And it's not about divorce and remarriage. So we're sticking some laws in there in order to make this thing sound good. Jill's ready to put him away in her mind. So she puts Jack away in her mind. Maybe she goes before the elders of the church. Maybe she's obeyed the gospel now and she knows the truth. And some well-meaning preacher who knows the Greek has taught her, well, you know, he's remarried and now he's committing adultery, so you can put him away in your mind and you can remarry. And so what Jill does is she does that and she believes because she put him away for his adultery, then she put him away for fornication, and now she can remarry. Of course, who does she remarry? John, a bunch of J's. And that's exactly where the doctrine belongs. It belongs with the J's. That's just all there is to it. But we need to answer. We need to talk about how do we answer a doctrine like this? Now, when we look at the question here, one of the first propositions is, God's law is never superseded by civil law. God's law is always reigning supreme. Now, what they want to do with this is they want to tell us that Jesus has stated the law of God on divorce and remarriage here, and it supersedes the civil law in which the divorce took place. Since God's law supersedes that law, in some way that must negate that law. But I want you to look at what this really means here. When we look at the situation, saying that God's law supersedes civil law, what this really means, what we're saying, what we've always said, is that civil law cannot make something right that God's law says is wrong. If God's law says it is wrong, then civil law cannot make it right. That's what we're saying by that. So understand at the very outset what we're talking about. Civil law, God's law. God's law says it's wrong. Civil law cannot come along and say it's right. Now that's a far cry from what we're doing here with this doctrine. Concluding that this keeps a divorce that is wrong from being a divorce completely jumps the track. It has nothing to do with what we totally slipped over into another area. God's law does not keep the civil law from doing what it's doing. It can do right and it can do wrong. And of course, in many, many cases, it does wrong where divorce is concerned, doesn't it? We all know that. Everybody would acknowledge that who is a Bible believer. No doubt about that. But when it comes to God's law and civil law, all we're talking about in supremacy here is the fact that civil law cannot make something right that God's law has said wrong. It doesn't say that God's law will keep the civil law from doing something that is wrong. That's what we try to do with it. Now, where do we ever find in Scripture that a divorce is not really a divorce? That's what I'd like to find. And that's what I have to find before I will accept this doctrine. Where do we ever find that a divorce is not really a divorce? Now, of course, what they would say is, well, it's obvious because of this word adultery. He has divorced his wife, and now in marrying someone else, he commits adultery. The only way he could commit adultery is if he's married. That's, you know, adultery is only used with regard to married individuals. So he has to be married when he marries the other person. So they're still married in the eyes of God. That passage does not say that. And before our lesson is over this morning, it's hard not to say this evening. Before our lesson is over this morning, I'm going to show you that there are times when the word adultery does indicate unmarried individuals. In fact, I could have spent the entire lesson on this. You wouldn't believe it. I'm going to tell you right now, our brethren have not studied this out. We've looked in Greek lexicons, we've looked in expository dictionaries, and we found little definitions, and we liked what we read, and so we copy it onto our charts, and we paste it up in front of people, and it's shameful. I have seen gospel preachers take a definition out of Vine's expository dictionary to prove their point, and I thought, I can't believe Vine says that. I turned over to Vine's to look at it, and I look at it, and what they did was they found the word that they were looking up, and they just read down until they found something that said what they wanted it to say, and they pasted that out of it, and when you drop on down, you find that this word actually, in this particular form, does not mean that right there. They didn't do any homework. Probably had a sermon that they needed to get done, and they stuck it in. Believe it or not, there are gospel preachers who do not study the way they ought to study. They don't work the way they ought to work. It's shameful, but we all need to recognize gospel preachers are not perfect. And of course, I'm in that number. We're not perfect, but I'll tell you what, we need to study. An expository dictionary, as helpful as it may be, it's dangerous in the hands of someone who's unwilling to love the truth and look for it. I'll give you one example. We had some ladies over in Conroe. One of the ladies, we had a family that had come in She had always made the communion bread wherever she had been. And she wanted to make the communion bread. Of course, I said, oh, good, because I don't like those matzos. Let's let her fly. So we went to the business meeting with it. The brethren liked it. She started making the communion bread. Two of the ladies said, this is not scriptural communion bread. Do you think I'm making this up? This is not scriptural communion bread. Well, why is it not scriptural communion bread? They said, because if you'll go to Vine's Expository Dictionary. Now, these are two little old ladies. They have Vine's sitting on their shelf at home. And I love them to death, and I know they meant well. And I know they believed what they were telling me. I'm not trying to say they were trying to pull something, but they did not know how to use an expository dictionary. What they did was they had gone to Vines, and they looked at the very first thing that Vines had to say, which was that the basis for the bread that we read of, the word that's used for the bread, the unleavened bread that Jesus used, the basis for that unleavened bread was flour and water. And they stopped reading, and they could taste the salt in the communion bread that this lady made. And they weren't happy. And I pointed out, you've not read that whole definition. It says the basis. And if you read on down, you'll find that the bread also had other things that could enter into it. Unleavened bread simply means there is no leaven in it. It doesn't mean there's no oil in it. It doesn't mean there's no salt in it. And heaven save us all, it doesn't mean there are no preservatives in it. Read the back of a matzo's box. We can look at Greek words from expository dictionaries and lexicons till we're blue in the face. But I'm going to tell you right now. If a lexicon, if a dictionary, if an encyclopedia, if some great scholar with all kinds of letters after his name, if they have anything to say that's other than what we find in the Bible, then throw them out. Because I'm not going to be saved by them. I'm going to be saved by my Lord, and I'm going to be saved by His inerrant Word. And if I believe it's inerrant, I'm going to believe what it has to say. So when I look here at God's law and civil law, we have some individuals who would tell us that civil law supersedes. But God's law actually warns us against using the civil law in order to violate that which is divinely sanctified here. For example, the Lord said, let them not put asunder. This man is not to put his wife asunder. Can he do it? This doctrine says he can do it civilly, but he doesn't really do it because they're still married in the eyes of God. Jesus said he puts asunder when he does it. I either believe that or I don't believe that. Jesus said it and I believe it. When you divorce a mate, you have put them asunder. And it's just as real, it's just as valid, whether it's according to the law of God or it's not. It's still a divorce. Now, up in our country, we have a problem. We have a problem up there. We have a lot of people who've taken this, and I'll just abbreviate it. I know people don't like the phrase, but I'm going to abbreviate it with this. There's a law, and it's called the post-civil putting away doctrine. I'm just going to call it the mental divorce doctrine, okay? A lot of people up there taking this position. And this right here, the idea that marriage is a covenant between God and the couple. You've got George and Nancy down here, and they're married. And what these people are saying is that George and Nancy, they've made a covenant with each other in marriage. But the truth is, the two of them have also made a covenant with God. Marriage is a covenant between them, but marriage is a covenant between them and God. And I'll tell you what, people up there have eaten it up. Churches all over that area are rife with this doctrine. And it's a big problem. This is what I walked into. You know, people wonder, why in the world did you move to West Virginia? I had one little girl over there in Conroe. She said, there's Yankees up there. And, you know, I had several things I could have said. One was, well, you know, missionaries go all kinds of places. But you know, I thought, well, maybe I just better point out to her, I was born in Indiana. Well, that stopped her real quick. The truth is, the church was in trouble up there. And this was a lot of it right here. And churches are in trouble up there. And they need to be straightened out on this. And the problem was very close by to Bethlehem. Up in Charleston, there were two preachers. They're not there now. The two preachers, Ron Chapin and Anthony Chen. And they wrote a paper. In the beginning of that paper, by the way, it says that you cannot quote from any of this paper unless you quote the whole thing. Well, there are two problems with that. First of all, they put it in the public domain, and you can't put that kind of restriction on something that you put in the public domain. The second problem is they didn't even have a copyright on the thing. So here's the only quote I'm going to use out of it. God plays a clear and undeniable role in marriage. That the beginning of marriage is a covenant into which we enter with God. In other words, a couple are entering into a covenant with God. And the mate, which we marry, is borne out in such passages as, and now I want to go through the passages with you. And I want you, in these passages that we're studying, I want you to look for the covenant between the couple and God. This is between God and the couple. He quote, they cite five passages. And I'm going to show them to you. Genesis chapter 2. We find here in Genesis chapter 2, they emphasize, of course, verses 23 and 24. Adam says, this is now bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. Therefore, a man shall leave father and mother and be joined to his wife. They shall become one flesh. Would you tell me where in that passage we are told that marriage is a covenant between God and the couple? It's not in there. That's the first one they cite. I'm citing these in order, by the way. That's the first one they cite. In Malachi chapter 2, verses 14 and 15, we find here, of course, a problem with the Israelites and what the errors, the sins that they've engaged in. One is divorcing their wives. Yet you say, for what reason are they having trouble with God? Because the Lord has been witness between you and the wife of your youth, with whom you have dealt treacherously, yet she is your companion and your wife by covenant. Oh, now we've got a covenant. Oh, okay. Does that say that marriage is a covenant between God and the couple? That's not what that says. That does not say that. She is your wife by covenant. The husband who's putting her away, he had made a covenant with the wife. Notice here in this text that he points out that the Lord was a witness. The Lord is not in the covenant between the couple and him. He is a witness to the treachery that the husband is committing against the covenant. It's a covenant between the two people. And so the covenant here is between you and the wife of your youth. Is marriage a covenant between God and the couple? And I know that some people like to romanticize it and make out. The Bible never tells us that. Now, let me tell you very quickly where they are going with this. Where they're going with this is the idea that man cannot in any way abrogate or nullify a covenant that God has made. When God makes a covenant with man, any covenant that God has ever made with man, and Chapin and Chinton, they go through a long series of Old Testament covenants and point out how man could not break the covenant. He could violate it, but God was the only one who could release. God was the only one who could sever the covenant. So what they're saying is that when it comes to marriage, God is in that covenant, and He's the only one that can sever it, that can make this division between husband and wife. So when civil law comes in, and civil law makes this divorce between a husband and wife, they say, as far as God is concerned, it's still there. There's still a covenant between them and God. And because that covenant is there, it is only severed or torn apart by God. Of course, this totally defies the command from the beginning, let not man put asunder. Man can't put asunder. Why command people not to put asunder if they can or can't put asunder? And so we have the covenant, and they're stuck together until God says otherwise. And that's what they do with Matthew 19 and verse 9. In this case, it's not a covenant between God and a couple. The Lord was a witness to the treachery in a covenant between two people. In Ezekiel 16, it just blew my mind, the kind of passage. These guys are supposed to be seasoned gospel preachers. They're supposed to be reasoning with the word of truth. And they use a passage here. It is of marriage, but it's between God and the nation of Israel. He tells Israel, you became mine. There are only two parties in this couple, in this particular passage. There is God and there is the nation of Israel. And in this particular situation here, this covenant is between God and the nation of Israel. It's not between a husband and wife and God. God is the husband and Israel is the wife. And there's nobody else. God and the wife. There is no covenant between God and a couple in this passage. This is about God and Israel. In Proverbs chapter 2, we have perhaps their best shot at doing this. In verse 16, to deliver you from the immoral woman, from the seductress who flatters with her words. You may recall that in Proverbs chapter 2, Solomon is reasoning with young men, his sons. Please, watch for this kind of woman. She is going to lead you to the grave. So he points out this seductress here. Verse 17, who forsakes the companion of her youth and forgets the covenant of her God. Oh, she's in a marriage covenant and God is involved in the marriage covenant. It's amazing how we can look at a passage and we can see there are two words in it we like and we just yank it out and we say, there I've got it. Not what that passage says. First of all, who is the companion of her youth? We assume when we read that verse by itself that the companion of her youth is her husband. When I read that context from verse 1 all the way down to verse 17, that doesn't fit. And the reason it seems to fit is because we translate it as companion. It can be translated that. But it also can be translated as guide. And so, I've got these backward here. And so, the guide here, I believe, is exactly the same as that in Jeremiah chapter 3 and verse 4. The associate. And it's the same kind of context, but it refers, obviously, there to God. It's not that she's forsaking the covenant with the husband. She's forsaking a covenant with her God. And notice at the end, even if the companion were her husband, I want you to notice it's the covenant not with her God. It's the covenant of her God. The truth is, Jetton and Chaffin, they have nothing in this or any of these other passages with regard to covenant, tying these two together, and you can't sever the covenant. Only God can do that. There's just nothing in that. They have wasted 32 pages on a lot of rubbish. Romans 7 is the last one that they point out. And you'll see as you look here, we have the woman, she has a husband, she's bound by the law to her husband as long as he lives. Doesn't say anything about the two of them being bound by covenant to God. It's not there. It's not implied. It's not even imaginable unless you're just trying to imagine passages that will support something you've already dreamed up. So Romans chapter 7 doesn't do it either. They're simply bound by the law to each other. And of course, God is bound by that law, but they're not in a covenant with God in that. Their covenant with God is individual, not as a couple. Their covenant is individual with God, and of course that would be in Christ Jesus. The covenant here is with the husband. Now, as we go a little bit further here, we look at Matthew 19. And as I mentioned a moment ago, Jesus has said that man can put asunder. Here in verse 6, what God hath joined together, let not man try to put asunder. I guess that word try, I guess it's one of those reading words that the translators are supposed to insert. Jesus said, let not man put us under, or separate us here in the New King James Version. Let him not, can a man separate? Now these people will tell you, no, man cannot separate. He's not, only God can do that. So modern preachers are saying it's an impossibility. It's an impossibility. Jesus here is saying that man can't. Not with permission. He's not saying that they may. He's saying that they can't. It is possible for them to put asunder, for them to divorce. He says they can do it. And later on in verse 19, as we're going to look a little bit more closely, we're going to see man does indeed put asunder when he divorces. And so marriage is not a covenant between God and the couple. And as I said, we've wasted 32 pieces of paper and the toner to copy that silly thing off. It really means nothing. Now, when we look a little bit further, let me back up here for just a moment. You know, a lot of times people will talk about the emotion of all of this. You know, it's really not fair. It's just not fair. Well, it obviously is not fair. And we as human beings, we love always to draw the emotions into it. You know, I mentioned Brother Jenkins here and institutionalism. Now, Brother Jenkins knows very well the play on emotion that will be made, especially in the past with regard to, oh, well, we've got to get the gospel out here, and we're just not able to do it in the way that we're doing it with the churches being autonomous. We need to band together, and we need to create a big machine to take the gospel out. All these souls are dying, they're being lost. Or we'll talk about the poor little orphan over here. We'll talk about how the orphan's dying, and what are you doing to help the little orphans? You know, we can go a lot of directions in emotion, and this is no different. What about poor Jill? You remember Jill. Jack put her away. Of course, it was all his fault. Let's just say for a moment, it was all his fault. You know, a lot of times, it's both fault. A lot of times, it's something on both sides. But when a guy divorces, or a woman, in either case, you know, that's not an answer who was at fault. Doesn't matter who was at fault. But when it comes right down to it, Jack has divorced Jill. Poor Jill over here. And now Jack has remarried. He's married Jane. And now it's just not fair. Here is Jill, and she's all alone. What do you think? Jack's really any better off? You want to know something? He's going to hell. I don't know why we think he's got it made now. He's all right. He's not all right. He's going to hell. He's committing adultery. I don't ever hear anybody make that point. But that's the truth of it. And so we look at Jack and Jill here. And of course, here's where we left it. Here they are in adultery. Jill hasn't remarried yet in this chart. But Jack and Jane, they are remarried. They are married. Jack's remarried. Jack is committing adultery, and it's just not fair for Jill. I don't know how we get that. Well, let me change this a little bit here. Let's just say that Jack doesn't remarry. Let's just say that he never remarries. Let's say that he stays unmarried the rest of his life. I want to ask you, is that fair now? Does that look fair to you? That didn't become unfair when Jack remarried. That became unfair when Jack put Jill away. But of course, that doesn't sound as good when you're trying to make an emotional argument. It just doesn't work. Let me put another one out to you. What if Jack divorces Jill? Of course, people look at this and they say, well, there's no way Jack is going to divorce Jill and then he's never going to remarry. You think that's never happened? Give me a break. But let's just say for a moment that Jack divorces Jill, the situation we've talked about. And let's just say for a moment that Jack goes out and robs a bank and he kills someone and he's put on death row, or maybe he is put in prison for life. And he pulls life, and there he is in prison. He's not going to remarry now. Is it fair for Jill? And maybe she has a 2-year-old, a 5-year-old at home, and he was providing child support. Now he's in prison. You know, you can get really emotional with this stuff. What good has it done? It hasn't gotten any fairer, has it? It doesn't get fair. We try to play these emotional arguments in order to make some kind of point, but it does not get fair. What about the man who has the wife who goes insane? And she's violently insane. And they have to put her away for life. And while he hasn't divorced her, is that fair? Is that fair? about the guy that's on his way down to the water, and he's going to be baptized, and lightning hits a tree, the branch falls off, and it hits him in the head, knocks him down and kills him. Is he going to go to heaven? Oh, wait a minute. That's a different sermon, isn't it? But while we're there, does the emotional argument do anything? Does it prove anything with regard to truth? You see, when we have talked to the denominations for years, they've pulled out these emotional arguments on us. What about the guy on his way down to the creek and lightning hits the tree and the branch falls on his head and he died and he didn't get in the water and he wasn't baptized? Is he going to be saved now? And we've lambasted the denominations for their use of these silly emotional pleas. But you know, it's all fair game when it's brother debating brother. And now we're going to start arguing about divorce and remarriage. I'll tell you right now, you need to leave all that out of it. You need to look at what the Scriptures have to say on this particular subject. Now let's go to Matthew 19. Let's talk about the still married in the eyes of God. And of course, the idea that they're still married in the eyes of God is all about the idea that he's committing adultery, so they must still be married, because adultery has to take place with someone who's married. Well, we need to look a little more closely at that. The question of how can a person commit adultery when he's no longer married is one that should have had a lot more attention given to it, rather than simply trying to stick a phrase of "they're still married in the eyes of God." So we go to Matthew chapter 19 and verse 9. We have the husband with the faithful wife. We already looked at that. Now what I want to notice first here is that when we look at the subject of committing adultery in this passage, we need to be very, very careful with how we apply it and how we try to explain it away. This man with the faithful wife, he divorces this faithful wife. And of course, when he divorces her, we're told that he didn't really divorce her. You see, he went to the civil authorities and he got a civil divorce, but it's not really a divorce in the eyes of God. You understand that, because later on, when he marries, he commits adultery, so they must still be married. So it's not really a divorce. We find that he marries someone else, but he can't really marry her. I mean, that would be polygamy, wouldn't it? So they're not really married, and now he is committing adultery with this other woman. When we look at the subject matter of this verse, though, we have another side to the coin, and that is the husband who has the unfaithful wife. When you have a husband who puts away an unfaithful wife, when he divorces her, what has he done? This time it really is a divorce, isn't it? I don't know anybody that would say it's not a real divorce now, but this time it really is a divorce. And they say, well, yeah, it's really a divorce now. But I want you to look at this verse very, very carefully. I want you to see what these people are doing with this verse. I want you to look. This one word is being used both ways. You see that? In one case, it's not really a divorce. But in the other case, it really is a divorce. I mean, some of the times people try to do this with the same word in two different verses. This is the same sentence and the exact same word in the sentence, and they're trying to make it say two different things according to a circumstance. Can you think of any other teaching that the Lord gave where he did this with a single instance of a word in a sentence and he meant two different things at the same time? I'm not talking about a play on words. I'm talking about a doctrinal application that had eternal ramifications. Not really, but really? From one word? Come on now. That cannot be. He marries another. This time it really is a marriage, because you see, he put away the unfaithful wife, and the exception allows him to remarry. But wait a minute. The marries another here does the same thing. It goes back to the exact same phrase earlier. And what we have here is, in one case, he's saying that they don't really marry another and it's adultery, but in the other case, they really do marry another because it's all right with God. Can you imagine Jesus teaching like that? And that's what some of our brethren are trying to make out of the words of Jesus. It ought not to be. Brethren asked me if I think that this is an opinion, and I've asked other preachers around what they thought about this, just to kind of feel them out. I look at that right there. That's not an opinion. That is a perversion of what Jesus has said. Simple, outright perversion of what Jesus is saying. Trying to have it both ways in the same verse. It's not an opinion. This is something that has some very grave consequences. We'll talk a little bit more about that further on. And so we find that in this case, of course, he does not commit adultery. Now here in Matthew 19, as we talk about still married in the eyes of God, can't be. Can't be, because you can't have it both ways at the same time. It just won't work. But let's talk about this idea of an unmarried person committing adultery. You've always heard that only a married person can commit adultery. There are several problems with this easy answer that has been given. There are several problems, and like I said earlier, you can spend the entire sermon. My eyes have been open since I moved to Beckley and I started digging into this and realizing, for example, I never realized that the Hebrew that the Jews would have relied on as far as the law of Moses is concerned, and that's what's being argued from here in Matthew 19, the Hebrew does not have a distinct word that makes a distinction with regard to fornication and adultery. When you have fornication, it's usually referring to the idea of harlotry, it's true enough. But you have a connection here as well, as far as fornication, that it will also be used of adultery. So we look at Jesus' words and we say, well, the Greek, it said Jesus isn't arguing with Greeks. So I have to stop and I have to think, have we really thought this thing out? You know, I'm still thinking that aspect of it out. But there are some conclusions that I draw that I cannot, for the life of me, understand why we've not given some consideration to them. For example, back to Matthew 19:9. The husband has an unfaithful wife. Okay, that's all we're talking about now. A husband, his wife has cheated on him, so he is going to divorce the unfaithful wife. And you know that having divorced her, what this does, when he marries another, he has the right to marry her, right? He can marry because his wife had cheated on him. He put her away for fornication. The exception now allows him to marry another. So he has married another. Is he married to his first wife? Are they married? If they are married, what is he? He's a polygamist, isn't he? Is Jesus saying he's still married to the first wife? We know he's not saying that. The man is not married. Let's take Jack and Jill for a moment. Jack put away Jill because she had cheated on him. Now Jack marries Jane. Is Jack still married to Jill? No, they can't still be married. And we all acknowledge that. Everybody, even the people that take this position. And Jack is now married to Jane. So that's the situation that we have right here. So he does not commit adultery. But notice something. We have the unfaithful wife at the end of this verse. What happens? He says here, whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery. Jill was put away for fornication. Whoever marries her, what is it? It is adultery. Well, if it's adultery, then in some way there must be a marriage connection. She can't. She or he can't commit adultery unless there's a marriage tie there in order to create it. So the new husband commits adultery. But I want to ask, to whom is Jill married? To whom is Jill married that her new husband is now committing adultery? Be careful now. Because if you say that she is still married in the eyes of God, to who? If you put her still married in the eyes of God to Jack, what has happened is Jack has scripturally married Jane, and now in the eyes of God, Jack has two wives. That doesn't work. That doesn't work. So if Jack is unmarried, what is Jill? Jill is unmarried. And of course we're asked,
We're asking, to whom is she married to make this adultery? Since Jack is unmarried. But I think the question is wrong. Do you have to be married, or does there have to be a marriage in order for Jesus to use the word adultery in this text? And I don't believe that's the case. I don't believe that's the case. I don't believe it is borne out when we look at the scriptures a little more fully. What this tells me is that an unmarried woman can commit adultery. Now, I don't care what Thayer, what Bauer, what Kittles, and we'll talk about Kittles in a moment. I like what he says. Vines, I don't care what anybody says on it. When I exercise and run Jesus through the ringer, studying what he has to say, that's what he has to say. An unmarried woman can commit adultery. You may not like that with what the scholars say. Look at Matthew 5, verse 28. We've used that for years. What have we done with that verse for years? For years and years, we've taken Matthew 5 and verse 28, we've gotten up in the pulpit, and we have taught our young men, you need to be careful about looking at the opposite sex. Because you have no business looking at them. If you look at them with lust, you've committed adultery with them already in your heart. You know, I've sat at the feet. When I was young, I can remember sitting at the feet of one particular brother and him pleading with us young boys not to be looking at the opposite sex and not to be desiring, because this is adultery that you commit in your heart. That very same preacher now is telling me that I could not have committed adultery in my heart then because I wasn't married. I wasn't married. And yet Jesus says adultery. There's a problem here. And of course, if they want to keep this doctrine, then they're going to have to repudiate and say, well, we were wrong. Only married men can commit adultery. And so, only married men have that problem? Oh, now that has some serious ramifications. But we say, well, it applies only to married men, but the unmarried men, it's still a problem. They would commit fornication in their heart. Well, now you're starting to leap. You're starting to leap right out of the Bible and say what you want to say. Jesus said that you commit adultery in your heart. Can I do that? Could I do that when I was still unmarried? I believe I could. If I look at a woman to lust after her when I'm not married, I commit adultery in my heart. Doesn't matter whether I'm married or unmarried. Doesn't matter whether she's married or she's unmarried. It's adultery in my heart. I think a lot of it goes back to the fact that we're talking to people who knew the law of Moses, and we're talking about the law of Moses, and there just is not that distinct word that we expect to find in what Jesus says. But that's another study, as I said. But what this does tell us is that you can commit adultery, at least in your heart, when you're unmarried. So, my answer is Jesus said so. I don't care what Bauer says. I don't care what anybody says. Jesus said so. In Matthew 19:9, here in Matthew 5, verse 32, doesn't matter where you want to go, either one, that Jesus said so. But let's look for a moment at Paul. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, Paul said that a wife is not to depart from her husband. That depart there, what does that mean? That means divorce, without a doubt. She's talking about divorcing a husband. It says, let her remain unmarried or be reconciled. Of course, one point is that if she divorces him, she is unmarried. But that's not what they're saying. She's still married in the eyes of God. Paul says she's unmarried. I believe Paul. A wife is not to depart. If it does take place, she is to remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. Those are the choices. And so what Paul is saying here is that a woman who has divorced her husband, just as a husband divorces his wife, the end of that makes it clear. If you weren't sure what departing meant in verse 10, the end of verse 11 will tell you. She's divorced her husband, and what Paul is telling us here is that when a woman divorces her husband, she is unmarried. Now, I want you to look at Romans 7 for a moment. This is the same guy, Paul, the Apostle Paul. Remember him? He spoke to us back here in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Here in Romans chapter 7, a woman who has a husband is bound by the law to her husband as long as he lives. Now, if she is unmarried, look at what he says here in verse 3. While her husband lives, she marries another man. What is she called? What is she called when she marries the other man? Paul tells the Corinthians she's unmarried when she's divorced that husband. And here we have her going on and marrying someone else. We have the next step that's not considered just right there where we were looking in 1 Corinthians 7. And when she marries another man, what is she called? It's called an adulteress. Didn't call her a fornicator. Called her an adulteress. She's unmarried. Paul said so. What does that tell me? That tells me an unmarried person can commit adultery. I don't care what the encyclopedia says. I want to know how Jesus was using these words. And by the way, that's what you have to have when you have an encyclopedia, a dictionary, a lexicon. What those guys try to do is they try to put the language in the context of how it was used. When I look at the way Jesus uses these words, or Paul uses these words, that's what the lexicon is supposed to do for me. My friend, it is not inspired of God. The lexicon is not. And I cannot expect them to do all my homework for me and get me to heaven. What I find here is Jesus and Paul have given me an adequate definition. Paul told the Corinthians in this case a woman in this position was unmarried, but here she's an adulteress, an unmarried person and an adulteress. Imagine that. Paul says that this can be. Now I want to leave you here with Kittles. Kittles is, it's kind of here and there as far as the way some people accept it. You can find a lot of people that really bash Kittles. But for many years it has been the big theological study for words in the Bible. And here we find in the Theological Dictionary of the New Testament, under the heading of adultery, this particular segment. For this reason, the remarriage of a man after divorcing his wife, or the remarrying of the divorced woman, notice he caught both of those situations from Matthew 19:9, is tantamount to adultery. And see, the others, they very handily just slip in, is called adultery. But here, Kittles recognizes some distinction. That word tantamount is very interesting. I mean, when you're writing, if you don't want the word tantamount in there, you're probably going to find something shorter. But tantamount's what he needed. Tantamount very simply means equivalent in value, significance, or effect. I think Kittles hit the nail right on the head. It is not that the man is still married and that's why he's committing adultery and remarrying. It is that this act is tantamount to adultery. And what that tells me is that Jack and Jill are not still married in the eyes of God. And it also tells me something else that concerns me even more. Because when I look at this situation, obviously the person cannot put away someone to whom they're no longer married. This idea that, well, he divorced me, but now he's remarried, and that's adultery, so now I'm going to put him away in my mind, that doesn't happen in the Bible. That only happens in our modern society, where divorce has kind of pushed us around to where we feel like we need to explain away the words of Jesus. We ought never be trying to do that. When people are unscripturally divorced, they are not still married in the eyes of God. Jesus said they're unmarried, they're put away. Paul said they're unmarried, he explicitly said so. And so they're not still married in the eyes of God. Passages on divorce and remarriage in Scripture make it clear that it can be appropriate to use the word adultery of an unmarried person. And I'll tell you what, that will just floor brethren. That's not what has been taught through the years. It's just, it's inconceivable. But that's what the scriptures tell me. Whatever I find in all the scholars. Now, the implication of all of this is extremely grave. Some of our brethren are trying to throw this off to opinion and just let those who want to preach it, and let them go their way. And of course, a quote from Edmund Burke would be very appropriate right here. Of lots of good people just standing by and letting it float by. Listen to what we have when we look at this situation. We have brethren who are encouraging unlawful remarriages. If they aren't still married in the eyes of God, then they can't put away in the mind what happens when Jill, in that first scenario where Jack has put her away, no fornication involved, and Jack remarries, and she says, oh, well, now he's committing adultery, so I'll put him away in my mind, and then she remarries. My friend, she's committing adultery. She's committing adultery. Now, I don't have to tell you what that means as far as eternity is concerned. We can turn to Galatians chapter 5, verse 19, real fast. We can find that adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lasciviousness, all of these things are things you will not see the kingdom of God or enter the kingdom of God having committed these things. Many brethren are teaching that this is just a matter of opinion, so they're letting it slide. Just let it go. It's not convenient to buck a big-name preacher. And there are big, big, big-name preachers who are preaching this stuff. We're talking big, big. If you take the GOT, the Guardian of Truth, the Truth Magazine, you wonder why you don't hear about this on there? They've got board members that take this position. This is big. It is swallowing us alive, and we're just sitting back, and nobody is fighting it or realizing it. I say nobody. I'm speaking of that relatively. And we need to oppose it. We need to be willing to stand up and say, no, this is not the truth. We must take a stand now. Now, I realize that there are aspects of divorce and remarriage that may fall under the heading of judgment, a matter of opinion, here or there, little things that come along. But when you talk about someone who has remarried and their situation is described by Jesus as adultery, we're talking about not just the souls of those who are involved in that marriage. We're talking about brethren who have fellowship in that and who heartily approve of those things. We're talking about brethren who either allow it to slip by, who are actively preaching this as being the truth. This is a grave problem. As the problem of divorce gets bigger and bigger in our country, I just want to leave you with a question here. What do you think happens with regard to the way people stand for the Word of God, want to do His will? What do you think happens? You have more and more friends and neighbors and relatives that are getting divorced. Terrible situation. And as I said at the beginning, no one says any of it's fair. Is it fair that a man gets killed and his children lose their father? There are a lot of things in life that aren't fair. But we need to recognize that the supreme problem here is that we have a false doctrine that is growing, that is spreading, and is teaching people to marry into adultery. That's serious. And now you enter into the world of the Northeast and the East. West Virginia, Virginia. We have a little bit of it over here. But you start getting up into there, and it's a hotbed. And it's going to be coming more and more right here. You need to watch for it. And you need to be aware of it. Well, I have very good news. I've taken up a lot of your time with this lesson. And I told George ahead of time I was going to. You'll notice we knocked one soul off. See, I already told him. The good news is, this is the longest sermon out of the whole series that I preached this weekend. So you see, you've got it behind you. You know, you can make up a badge and you can tell the ones that weren't here this morning, you know, you don't get one. But this afternoon, I'll kind of compensate the other one, but we're going to talk about taking what God offers. Taking what God offers. And I hope that you can be back for that. If you're not yet a Christian, why won't you become a child of God? Why won't you obey the one who loved you and died for you? And there you're going to just stand. Will you just stand there as we sing this song? Do you believe that Jesus is the Christ? Repent, confess Him, be baptized into Him. Everything here is ready. The only thing that you need is submissiveness, a willingness to obey and act on that belief. Would you do that now? Would you come while we stand and while we sing?